Welcome, everybody, to All About Symbian. This is Insight Podcast number 207, recording this on Tuesday, the 20th March, 2012, and hopefully we'll get this up very shortly afterwards. I'm Steve Litchfield, and with me up in Hull, I have...
David Gilson. Hello, everybody.
And down in Sussex, the main man himself, Mr. Rafe Blandford.
Hello, everybody. Good to be here.
Ewan is back from America after his South by Southwest adventure in music and media, but I think he's available... perhaps going off to Eurovision or something. He's not around anyway, but you'll probably catch him on the All About Windows Phone podcast later on in the week, so watch out for Mr. Spence there. Now, there are a few updates also. The Nokia E6 has received an update over the air for its character counterfix. Basically, what happened is after the Bell update, you'd go in to type a text message, and you'd be typing away, and there's no number on screen telling you how many characters you've got left in your single 160 characters, Rafe?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, no counter whatsoever, which is no use to man nor beast. Obviously, a glitch someone had forgotten to put in. They've now added that back in. It's just called Messaging App Update. And there's also an Agenda Server update to tie in with Lotus Notes Traveler, should you use that. Add the two in, and you're basically back up to speed again. The E7, interestingly, is exactly the same bug in landscape mode, but that hasn't been patched yet, but hopefully coming soon. Of course, the E7 owners can just close their keyboard and then see the character counter in portrait mode, but it's not exactly ideal. Ray, did you apply this to your phones?
I applied it to my E6. It all happened very smoothly, and actually I think in one sense that was quite impressive. This was an update for an individual application. If you look at the size of the file, it's obviously updating the whole application rather than just a bit of it, as you'd probably expect. But it's a good example of how the firmware over-the-air technology has come on a long way, you know, being able to update an individual application rather than do a whole firmware update or a bug fix firmware update. And it all worked very smoothly. It was good to get the character counter back on the E6. I have to admit, I hadn't been too worried. I'd just been sending text messages, probably because most of the time mine aren't long enough to go over that limit. But for a lot of people, it's kind of one of those things you absolutely have to have. And I can remember back when I think Microsoft first launched Windows Mobile, as it was then, that was one of the really big strikes against it, that it didn't have a SMS character counter in the original smartphone, in the Stinger device, I think it was. And it came out that the reason for this was because the American developers who were, you know, developing it over in Seattle just didn't use text that much, and so didn't think it was that big a deal. But obviously it is a big deal, so it's great to see this come in a small update.
Yeah, I always take pride in going to exactly 160 characters using, just to show people. I think, wow, there's so much text there. How does he do that? And it's just the full 160 characters, and it's kind of a point of pride, really. But very similar to writing a tweet these days. I like to use every single character I can whenever possible.
But it still costs £500 per megabyte to send a text message.
Indeed. Also updated, there's a new version of the Nokia Store client. It's still in beta, technically. Nokia like to keep rolling it through Nokia Beta Labs first and then release it when it's fully in production form, which is fine. And the new version, version 3.24.050, improves the user experience for the application updates, and that's very good, especially when there's multiple items available. It basically queues them one after the other, and sometimes it's not always obvious what's going on, but basically this is more robust now. Also a load of critical bug fixes, and also improves the responsiveness of the UI while files are downloading in the background. So all eminently worthwhile. Go grab it from Nokia Beta Labs, which, by the way, works really well on the mobile site, Rafe. I just don't bother going to the desktop version anymore. Now I find out that something's available on beta. I go to betalabs.nokia.com, and the site just works brilliantly, like All About Symbian and All About Windows Phone.com. It works brilliantly on the mobile device, and you basically download from there. No need to sideload at all.
Yeah, and the other benefit of it is that once you've signed in, which is the only requirement, that it will recognize your device and provide you with the right download file. So it's a lot easier than trying to remember to get the right file. I mean, most people listening to this podcast will be able to identify the right file, but it's easy enough to make a mistake, especially when they're sitting side by side on the page. I know I've done it myself. And yes, I'm the same. I just pop over to the mobile site and have everything running very quickly. And I think it helps that the browser's been updated in recent software updates. So you've now got a pretty fast browser. You never have any lag on anything like that.
Yeah. Now, here's an odd one. I've been reviewing the Nokia Play 360 wireless speakers and also the Jawbone Jambox, a Bluetooth stereo speaker. Now, at Nokia World, guys, you both play with the Play 360, I'm guessing, at the various audio stands, and a very impressive bit of kit it is, too. People can go and read my review over at allaboutsymbian.com, of course. It's about 1,000 words long, with lots of nice pictures, and you can see what I thought about it. Basically, mind-blowing audio quality. And of course, you can pair the two to have nice stereo sound. You've got NFC enabling to simplify the Bluetooth pairing if you've got a C7 or a 701, for example. But here's the big question, guys. Yes, it's fabulous quality hardware. Yes, fabulous sound for both devices, the Jawbone Jambox and the Play 360. But the price, I mean, the Jawbone Jambox is over £100. The Play 360 is probably just under £100 if you shop around, but you probably need two of them. It's a huge amount of money just to give you a speaker system allied to your phone. I mean, most portable speakers in the past, Rafe, have been, £20-30. You think, well, okay, that's enough for an accessory. But £220 worth of Play 360 just to amplify the sound coming out of my phone speaker, that's a heck of a lot.
It is a lot of money. I mean, what I will say about the 360, I've actually got one myself, is that the quality is really very good indeed. So we are talking, you know, you're paying what you get for. And I'd actually argue that for a lot of the time, you probably only need one speaker if you're looking to put a bit of music into a room, and particularly if you're using it for spoken word stuff. And, you know, typically the smaller speakers don't have that good a range, or they distort, or they don't sound very good from across the other side of the room. The thing about the 360, and the reason it's called the 360, it has this kind of 360 sound effect that comes out the top of the speaker. So it sounds a lot better than your kind of standard mono speaker anyway, and it has excellent coverage. So to an extent, you're getting what you pay for.
And you're right. Hang on a minute, Rafe. You're saying omnidirectional sound. You're buying into Nokia's marketing speaker. It's a speaker pointing upwards, for goodness sake.
I am buying into it a little bit, but this is comparing it to kind of other mobile speakers. And, you know, I've had the £25 jobs that you plug into the side of the phone, and you can't really compare them in terms of the quality. Yes, some of it's marketing speak, but there is a genuine, this is how the speaker is positioned within it. So I'm willing to give them a bit of leeway because it sounds better to me, you know, whether technically it is or not, I wouldn't like to say. And, you know, yes, it is just for your phone, but you can use it with any other audio equipment you might have. I mean, there's probably a bit of a swizz these days because I don't think that many people carry around both a phone and a separate audio player, but you can plug it into through the auxiliary input, and I think it's the same for the Jambox as well. So these things are a lot more versatile than they used to be. And the one thing that I think is definitely worth mentioning in terms of quality is it actually supports something called, I believe it's APTX, which is a Bluetooth audio technical specification, if you will, that allows higher quality music to come through. It's to do with the way the compression works and that kind of thing.
Is that the same as EDR, enhanced data rates?
No, it's different to that. It's actually related directly to the way that the music is encoded before it's transmitted over Bluetooth, where the EDR is really about the speed of the Bluetooth transmission. And you need to have APTX supported on both ends, and the Symbian devices do have this, as I believe as the Nokia N9, but I don't think Windows Phone has it at the moment, or many other platforms for that matter. There are individual devices. I think Sony has quite a few devices that support it, for example. And obviously it's on the Play 360 as well. It's actually on a lot of the Nokia Bluetooth accessories. There's a remote music receiver which you can plug into a standard pair of speakers that also has it, and a couple of the headsets as well. And that really pushes the music quality up. And if you listen to one side by side with something that doesn't have APTX, the difference is really notable. So for me, 360, yes, it is very expensive, but if you want to get the best possible kind of portable audio experience, you know, it is the one to buy. And it is kind of up there with the Bose and some of the other high quality audio manufacturers in terms of portable speakers. And it does work really well with the Nokia devices. The tap on the NFC stuff in particular is just, when you start using it, you wonder how you managed without it. It's very fiddly when you then have to do it by pressing a button on the side of the device to get the connection to work.
Now, Riv, you were saying about you can't really compare this to the sort of cheap £20 speakers. Now, I'm sat here, I'm looking at a pair of my cheap £20 speakers. And if anyone searches All About Symbian for X Mini speakers, they'll find my review of said speakers. Now, I think especially for money, they are fantastic little speakers. And also, I'm not an audiophile. So what do you think Nokia have to do to actually get the message across that this is really worth the money compared to such devices?
Yeah, it's a tricky question because, honestly, for a lot of people, those speakers will be fine. Because, I mean, I was trying to think about how often do I use external portable speaker. And the truth is, not all that much. It's kind of maybe when you've got some friends around, because otherwise I tend to be listening on a pair of headphones. Maybe when you go outside in the summer, that kind of thing. Versus kind of the cheapo speakers, which I actually sometimes listen to podcasts and things like that on, you know, around the kitchen or around the house, something like that. And yes, it is difficult, but I think it's kind of people will look at the price and decide which one is right for them. And you also have to look at the size, because typically the £25 speakers will be a lot smaller. They're a lot more portable than either the 360 or the Jambox. And this is a point that Steve made in his review. In order to get that better quality, they have had to increase the size. You know, I imagine it's a matter of physics as much as anything else, as only so small you can shrink things down before you start having distortion in the audio. Can they do anything specific? I mean, I guess the answer to that is in the marketing, really. Maybe they need to do some direct comparison videos, things like that. You can look at the specifications, and I'm sure that's what audiophiles will be doing in terms of looking at things like the dynamic range and the specifications of the speaker unit itself. But other than that, it's probably not a lot they can do. And I think it's fair to say, you know, the Play 360 is never going to sell on the same level as those £25 portable speakers that you can get from multiple companies.
Yeah, it's worth noting that the Jawbone Jambox, which I reviewed previously, didn't work fully with the Symbian devices. I tried it on the N86 and the N8 and the C7. Basically, I think the N86 controlled the volume perfectly, but the Symbian Anna and Symbian Bell devices didn't. And that's, I think that's a bug in Bell, which they can probably patch at some point. But this is very interesting because the Play 360s, being Nokia branded, they obviously had tested that and put the right hooks in. So, Rafe, when I tried adjusting the volume from my Nokia C7 yesterday and also from my N8, it worked perfectly using the volume buttons. So there's obviously some tricks here and some subtleties in the A2DP control protocols that Nokia seem to have sorted with their own kit.
Yes, I think that's right. You know, obviously when they're testing these things, they will tend to test with the more recent devices. And I think it's a shame sometimes that you don't go back and test with everything, but you can understand why it happens. But I mean, I think that's one of the advantages of buying a Nokia accessory as opposed to a third party, is you're pretty much guaranteed, if you've got the not necessarily the latest, but a Nokia device, and especially if you've updated it to a more recent software, you're going to get a good experience. It's going to work well. And that's kind of reflected in that NFC technology you're talking about. You know, you tap the speaker, it will start playing the music, and you tap it again, it stops playing it. That works best with the Nokia devices. Theoretically, it can work with other devices, but it does require the manufacturer of those devices to implement the right bit of, if you like, activation, which I don't think anything's actually done yet.
Yeah, moving on. David's written an excellent article all about micro SIMs, a bit of a saga, really. I remember back in the days of the N95, your SIM card would just sit in a little tray under the battery, and you could probably prop it in place with a piece of blue tack. Things have gone a lot rather fussier since then. The N8, for example, has quite a slim SIM socket, and it's all embedded deep in the guts of the machine. And basically, you have to have something that's exactly the same size as a SIM card. No protrusions, no funny bits. Otherwise, something will get broken. David came to me and said, should I cut my SIM down to micro SIM so that I can use it in the Lumia 800 and then put it back in an adapter in the N8? I said, no, don't go there. You'll break something. And he kind of did. David, can you summarize your entire saga? And also, what lessons can we learn from this in terms of cutting SIMs and maybe ordering new ones?
Okay, well, the first thing to keep in mind, If you are going to go down this road, and I don't particularly recommend that anyone does, but some people just need to. The first thing is that because of these really confined spaces like the N8 that SIM cards have to go in these days, you need something that is an absolutely tight, solid fit with no edges that anything can catch on, because that is the root of all problems. It's that a lot of these cheap micro SIM adapters are not good fits, and so the mechanisms inside a SIM slot, especially the electric contact pins that talk to the SIM card, get caught, and because they're actually like delicate little hooks, and they can get easily bent and damaged and won't work properly anymore. And the there's two types, broadly speaking, there's two types of adapter that you'll find, say if you go on eBay and look for micro-SIM adapters. There's an outline type, which is basically like a plastic SIM card with a micro-SIM shaped hole in it. And then there's another type that's like that, but it's got a wall on one side of the hole. And in my experience, neither of these work very well because the outline type actually needs a sticker to hold the micro-SIM in place, which I think is just a terrible idea because the sticker's going to get rolled up and you're going to get sticky residue in the slot. So that's a terrible idea. And the other type, this thin like plastic membrane that's on the side of it has got a circular hole and the whole thing is quite convex. So that's just begging to get caught on something. However, after a lot of looking around, I found reference to another type of adapter, which was kind of broadly referenced as the original German patented micro-SIM adapter. And it looks very much like the outline type, but it has got some diagonal bracings across each corner of the hull. And I found that all of my micro-SIMs, either like original micro-SIMs or ones that I'd cut myself, really snapped firmly into place. And I found that that worked best in all of my devices. However, because of the extra depth, it did cause a little bit of damage in my N8. It did sort of like crush some of the pins. So, like, for example, my main SIM card, which I did eventually cut down, will now only work as a micro-SIM in a micro-SIM adapter because it just needs that extra bit of padding to make contact. The other lesson that I would take from this actually goes to the network operators. If they supplied duplicate SIMs, so obviously it would cause problems if we were using two SIMs on the same number at the same time. But if we did have a mini SIM and a micro SIM that we could alternate between devices without having to move SIMs around, it would make this transition to micro SIMs much smoother for the people who it matters to, because I mean we do have to realize that a lot of people who are getting phones that need a micro SIM, like an iPhone, like a Lumia 800, like an N8, N9, are going to be supplied with a new SIM from their network operator. But there are a lot of people who I imagine the sort of people who are listening to this podcast are going to want to be moving their SIM around between devices a lot, and such people as that need help, and not in the way that you're thinking.
Surely, David, maybe Rafe can answer this as well. Surely, if a network supplies you with a micro SIM and a SIM, okay, we know they can't both be used at the same time. Surely, when you put one of them in a device, you power it on, it registers itself on the network. The network then knows your number is in use with a SIM card, blah, blah, blah. So if you happen to put, say, the micro SIM in a different device and power that on, it'll say, can't register, you know, SIM not recognized, or some error. And then later on, you power the other device down, you power the micro SIM slot device up, and that registers on the network, which automatically locks out the previous one. This doesn't seem like rocket science to me. Rafe, is there any reason why this couldn't happen?
Well, the reason this doesn't happen is it obviously costs the network something to do that kind of implementation. They have to write something on their back-end registration, and making it work seamlessly is not that easy. And so in a lot of countries, networks just don't bother. I mean, there are quite a few countries where this kind of technology is available. Even here in the UK, Vodafone do offer this kind of two SIM card things, and it was originally really intended for use in a car phone, you know, integrated car phone, and then use in a mobile handset. And you actually had to put in a code, something like *#02, to switch between the two SIM cards. And I know that's available in some European countries. In some countries, they actually provide the whole thing automatically. In India, for example, there's quite a few carriers that will let you have two different SIM cards. You can't use them both at the same time, but I think it works with the just switching one off and then the other one on. And that's great. So yes, I'd like to see more of that. I suspect the problem is there's just not enough customers demanding it that make it worthwhile for the operator in terms of, you know, the economic advantage. Because as I say, it costs something. Does that win them enough customers to make a difference? I suspect this sort of thing might become more prevalent in the future. I mean, because in one sense, there's two ways to solve this problem. You can issue multiple SIM cards for the same number, or you can issue a second line and give someone a second number. That's obviously not ideal, but a lot of the time when a customer wants a second SIM card, it's, you know, for maybe a MiFi device or a USB stick, you know, for getting onto the internet. It's kind of more unusual to have multiple phones running at the same time. But the kind of the rise of equipment that has a SIM card embedded into it means this issue isn't going to go away. And frankly, I would expect more and more people to have a second mobile phone, you know, a voice device. So yes, I'd like to see it happen more often, but I suspect it's purely the economics at the moment. And there is obviously, they have to do the implementation in the background. So I suspect this is an issue we're going to have for a while yet, and it's going to have particular relevance for the Symbian world quite soon, because of course the Nokia 808 PureView actually uses a micro SIM, and I'm sure there'll be people switching between something like the PureView and maybe a smaller Symbian device. And yes, then you'd need a micro SIM card and a standard SIM card.
If there's anyone listening to this who kind of thinks, oh, well, never mind my network, so I can do this myself, I'll get a blank SIM and clone my own SIM. I looked into this, and actually 2G SIMs were actually easy to copy, but 3G SIMs have a very tough encryption key built in, which you would have to crack, and doing so is illegal, so don't do it.
Okay, let's move on from that before someone gets their wrist slapped. Ionic is a new EPUB ebook reader, released a few days ago. I think it's still in beta, David. I've got you tagged down to doing the full review, but I have been trying it. It's really, really nice. There are a couple of issues to do with the glitchy performance and taking 10 seconds or so to come up after you've started the application, which I'm sure can be optimized. I'm sure there's some debug code in there. But once you're up and running, you've got a choice of light, dark, or sand themes. You can, for example, I like running it with black background and white text. It's really, really smooth scrolling. You can bookmark sections of a book and go straight back to them. It basically reads any DRM-free EPUB, and these days just about any non-DRM'd ebook can be available in EPUB form for download. Really, really swish. Give all feedback to the developer, please. I really would like to see this one get mature. Symbian's been without a really good, really swish ebook reader for far too long. I'm sure you'd give your amen to that.
Yes, I'm looking forward to reviewing this. There's a lot of people who have wanted a Kindle reader for Symbian, so this would be a close second, because especially if you go to, say, Project Gutenberg, there's plenty of EPUB format books there. So, I'm looking forward to it, and I think it would be a good addition to the software suite.
Yeah, a lot of people rather dismiss royalty-free and e-books. But I have to say, they say, you know, why can't we have the very latest thrillers from X, Y, and Z? I'm sorry, I've got a library of about 100 royalty-free classic books. I think, well, okay, when I run through those, I'll get on to the commercial stuff. I'm still only on about book 5 of 100, and that will take me basically the rest of my life. Rafe?
Well, I have to say, I do like my latest versions of of books, and I do use the Kindle device for that particular usage. But there are a lot of, you know, increasingly now you can actually buy even the commercial books sort of DRM free in an EPUB format, and some people will know that you can also remove DRM just as you can from music files. Obviously that's not legal technically, but if you want to be able to use EPUB files on your Symbian device, I think this is a very good option.
Okay, let's end on a moment of controversy, or even more controversy than we've had in terms of DRM and DRM stripping and micro SIM adapting. My top 10 QWERTY Symbian smartphones of all time. Quite a bit of controversy here, because among other selections, I did miss out the E7. I said the E7 wasn't worthy, and I was being a tiny bit fool here. Yes, I know. The E7 is a lovely device in many ways, but there are also some show-stopping problems. And I just wanted to just put up my stake in the sand and say, look, there are problems here, and I'm going to acknowledge it by missing it out of the top 10. And I stated my reasons. But, Rafe, do you want to just defend the flagship E7 communicator?
Well, I think you have to defend it, because it does have a keyboard that I think is really quite good to use. It's certainly the best in recent years in that clamshell form factor. And the integration, the design, you know, the big screen, the fact that you've got all the latest software running on it. You know, this is a device that runs Nokia Bell, has all the latest releases in terms of maps and social and all the other bits and pieces, and has a good range of, you know, third-party software through Nokia Store. Just means it stands out a little bit for me. And actually, I really like the design of this device. It feels incredibly solid. And people criticize some elements of the battery life, for example. And yes, I can understand that. However, you know, Steve gets very worked up about this user replaceable battery, and I can see the argument for, you know, in a couple of years' time, it would be very expensive to pay a service center to replace the battery. But in the meantime, I don't really have a capacity issue because it usually does a day for me. And I can plug in one of these external battery chargers if I need that little bit extra. And the other big criticism that comes against the E7 is its EDOF camera, particularly when it comes to document scanning. Personally, it's not an issue for me since I don't do it very much. But even when I do, I find that if I pull it away to sort of 30 or 40 centimeters, I can capture any document. And that's good enough for, you know, being able to read it afterwards. What it doesn't have is the onboard software to be able to then sort of do something interesting with that. I never found that particularly reliable for business cards or receipts or anything like that. And usually it was a case of just pulling up the image anyway. So I thought it was a bit harsh not to put it in your top 10, Steve. I mean, I think the combination of fantastic design and being right up to date means it deserves an entry. Maybe not at the very top, but certainly a middle rank, I would have thought.
David?
I think I'm going to have to speak with Steve on this one because it's actually an article of mine that Steve actually linked in his post was if you have a keyboard design that's very elongated and your thumbs are having to travel horizontally a lot, it's just hard work to type on it. And I have begrudgingly found that with E7. I mean, I love the form factor of E7, but it can sit on a desk as like a little laptop. And I have sometimes tried to type with my two index fingers or four fingers I've tried to type on it with, like a little laptop. But it's just not quick. It's just not fast. I will just give a little shout out to something I was pleased Steve put in the list for, that it was the E70, because this was the smartphone that sort of inspired me to be interested and notice smartphones, and it was the one that I never had, and I always wished I had.
Yeah, the E70 was a cracking little device. Obviously, incredibly quirky, but there was a certain charm to have it, something that's really out of the ordinary, and I think we're seeing that with some other devices today. Let's rush run through the top five rather than do the whole top 10 now, and people can go and read the article. Just get your thoughts on my selection, the top five Symbian Power quoted devices for their time in terms of what were classics. The Nokia 9500 at number five. Rafe, what do you think?
I'd have probably put the E7 in there instead. I mean, 9500 for its time was great. I do mean the E7, sorry. But looking at the 9500, it was a real brick of a device, and the keyboard, now this was in an era that wasn't that far after the sort of Cyan 5, and so the keyboard to me was always a bit of a disappointment on that device.
Yeah, I kind of liked it, and I know it's the very first communicator which had a camera, if I remember rightly, and having a digital camera, albeit a VGA, a camera in my smartphone with a QWERTY keyboard, that was just the start of the beginning of the modern age for me. And number four, the Nokia 9300i. David, did you have any qualifications here, or shall Rafe comment on that one too?
I'll hand over to Rafe on that one. That was a little bit before my time.
Okay.
Yeah, the 9300i stood out for me as, I believe, along with the 9300, which was kind of the same device, the i just had internet functionality a little bit extra, whereas you could actually lie flat the hinge, and I think that was a really nice feature in terms of being able to use it on the device. And it was kind of a shame we didn't see that happen more often, but you then got a similar style in the E90. And I can remember talking to a Nokia product manager at the time saying they hadn't realised that lying it flat on the desk was something that people wanted, and they could have done it before that point in time. But that was the innovation that sticks in the mind. And it was also really compact and small as a device, yet still surprisingly usable for that form factor. And it was kind of a shame it didn't come back in a kind of a thinner variant, because I really did quite like the design of the 9300i.
Now, of course, there is a DIY, a screen folding flat modification for the E7. I don't particularly recommend it, but if I just put the E7 on the desk and take this big hammer, hang on. yep, the screen's now flat. Okay. At number three, the Nokia E6, which is kind of the device I love to hate and love to love. Do you think it's fair at number three, David?
I think it's certainly a good advance. I mean, if E6 is up there, I can understand why Rafe wants the E7 higher. I think the E6, I mean, in theory, it should have been like the ultimate messenger phone for anyone like the E71 and E72. There was just something about it that I just couldn't quite gel with. I think it's partly to do with the pixel density and partly to do with like having a small touch screen. But it is a good, solid device.
Yeah, I think if it had an FM transmitter or just a few more media functions to take it slightly closer to some of the C7 and the N8, maybe NFC, for example, just something to push me over the edge, then I'd be using it every day. But at the moment, it just feels slightly old hat, slightly clunky, slightly fiddly. But just as I've said on my own phone show many times, a great, great backup phone for, you know, all purposes, all situations. Number two was the Nokia E61. This is going back a bit, Rafe, but it was pretty much indestructible, wasn't it?
It was. This was kind of the calculator phone. I can't say it was the most stylish device I've ever owned, but I love this one very dearly indeed. And I think a lot of people still like it because it had the kind of bigger screen that was unusual for these kind of quirky devices, which have since sort of shrunk a little bit.
Yeah.
And so, you know, yes, I have a very soft spot for the E61. I'm just going to sneak in a comment about the E6 and say that the thing about the E6, which I think everyone knows I love very much indeed, was it's kind of the ultimate example of a compromise phone. All smartphones are compromises in design, but I think nothing exemplifies this better than the E6, where, you know, you end up taking something, you add something, take something else away, but that combination of QWERTY and touch is a really, really nice idea, and I'd like to see that developed a bit more in the future. So I'd have probably swapped the E61 and the E6 around, but the E61, for its time, I mean, all of those original E-series devices, I think it was the E60, the E61, and the E70 with its gullwing design that Steve referred to earlier, were really stood out at the time for their build quality, but also they were real innovations, really, in the kind of business devices, that form factor, which had been dominated by kind of PDAs before that. So really quite remarkable for their time.
Okay, and at number one, I don't think I'll get too many arguments from the members of the team, and I didn't get very many arguments from the commenters on the story. The Nokia E71, which is basically fabulous build quality, still stands out as very usable today. It had basically the internal specs of the N95 8GB with masses of RAM, so it was really, really fast for its day. Beautiful keyboard, really variable readable screen in all conditions, battery that went on for days. I mean, there's nothing to not like, David.
Yes, and I mean, I had the E51, which is sort of these like 12 key variant of this, and it was, yeah, they are built like a tank. However, I would have to go for the E72, which you had ranked at number six, instead, because of the slightly more advanced software and because of the fantastic camera. And just a little bit of trivia on the E61. For quite a while, it did appear in EastEnders as Ian Beale's mobile phone.
I think I'm with Steve on the E71 at the top. I mean, the E72 was an improvement on it, but it just seemed to step back a little bit in terms of build quality for me, at least. I would agree with David, the camera was better, and if camera is important to you, yes, that was a factor. There was a small improvement in the keyboard as well, but my E71 survived a variety of disasters, me dropping it in a river, driving over it basically, and dropping it out of a second story window. There's a good story behind all of those, but it still works perfectly. People talk about indestructible phones, but I really, really did test the E71. It's still going strong. And so as a device I carried about for a year, I think I carried for a year to 18 months, which was a long time, given there were a lot of Symbian devices coming out. And every now and then I still sort of look at it fondly and, you know, stroke the side of it. And I probably shouldn't admit to that on a podcast, but it was a fantastic device. And, you know, when you're doing these kind of top 10 lists, you kind of have to do it in the context, because, of course, the latest device is always... was the greatest, but just thinking about the position where everything was when the E71 came out, that really announced Nokia's arriving in that QWERTY space, and it's since gone on to become the biggest manufacturer of QWERTY devices. It still holds that crown, and, you know, has an enormous number of them. And, you know, if you look at the devices today, it's things like the Asha 302, which was announced at MWC a couple of weeks ago, and the C3 that went before that, which was the GSMA's kind of feature phone of the year for 2011. You know, the E71 and that particular design has, you know, gone on to sell millions upon millions, I mean tens of millions of devices, with its kind of sister device and its descendants. So for me, the E71 really stands out as one of the very special Nokia devices. You know, it is very iconic for me.
Yeah, and it's a testament really to how many it sold and what Nokia thought of it themselves. that it bothered to port the free navigation version of Nokia Maps back to it, involving actually cutting the program down so that it would work on the older Feature Pack 1. So that was, again, a testament. Also, the fact that I did mention in the article I'd taken most of these devices to bits, which maybe I shouldn't have admitted, but the E72, David, for example, just basically falls to bits. You undo two Torx T4 screws and the device just falls apart, which is great if you want to clean the inside of the screen or fit a new case, as I did, but it's absolutely rubbish in terms of overall build quality. The E6 and the E71, my bike both had to really work with sort of six or seven screws and metal tabs and bits right and left and center, and the E71 in particular, really, really sturdy, and that just, it does explain why it survived all the abuse that Rafe's managed to hurl on it over the years. We're out of time, guys. It's been wonderful having you on. David Gilson, a goodbye from you.
Goodbye, everybody, and we'll see you next time.
Any last words from Mr. Rafe Blandford?
Well, thanks everyone for listening. Don't forget to check out the website at All About Symbian, Twitter at AAS, and Facebook at facebook.com/allaboutsymbian.
And don't forget to check out allaboutsymbian.com on your mobile, because it works really, really well these days. It is the full site. It just auto-scales. It's insanely inspired, genius web design, Mr. Rafe Blandford.
Oh, thank you, Steve. You're too kind.
Thank you very much for listening to the All About Symbian Insight podcast. We will catch you next week. Bye-bye.